This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we dig into the history of protest music, how it's changed over the decades, and what forms it takes today. Now, Trump-era tariffs on Chinese goods are still in effect, and with inflation becoming a big concern in the U.S., the Biden administration is thinking about whether reducing those tariffs could lower prices here in the U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen reportedly supports the move. Here she is on Bloomberg TV last month.
We're re-examining carefully our trade strategy with respect to China. And, I think it's worth considering. We certainly want to do what we can to address inflation, and there would be some desirable effects. It's something we're looking at.
But other officials say getting rid of those tariffs won't fundamentally change what's driving high prices, and they argue tariffs are part of a longer-term strategy to make China change the way it does business. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think tariffs on many Chinese products are a good idea? Do you like a tougher stance from the U.S. on China when it comes to trade? Or do you think more open trade without tariffs is a better way to go? Do you work in an industry that relies on imported Chinese products? Are the tariffs raising costs for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Rosalind Shea is an associate professor of political science and co-directs the political economy program at Temple University. She's written two books about China, including China's Regulatory State, A New Strategy for Globalization. Rosalind, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I know this is a huge, complicated question, but in general, what is the current state of affairs when it comes to U.S. tariffs on products coming from China?
Yeah, so, many people don't know this, but we are currently still in a trade war with China in that the different lists of tariffs, there were four lists of goods that were under tariffs, are in place. And we have also, though, been parallel to that, also have a list of exemptions, a list of products that are exempted from these tariffs. And so it's still ongoing. And as you told us in the introduction, there are now debates within the Biden administration on, what would be good economically to the United States and in terms of the future of these tariffs that are still in place.
Now, I understand that tariffs increase our cost in the U.S. some. How big a factor are they in our current inflation? How big a part of a solution could lower tariffs be?
Yeah, so I think that's a very critical question because, as Janet Yellen had said, potentially if we lift these tariffs, we could ease the inflation and cut consumer prices. But, there are other causes to inflation, right, including supply chain disruptions and rises in wages due to labor shortages during COVID. And so there are other, potential causes to inflation. So if these other potential causes to inflation do not go away, then would, lifting tariffs really necessarily change anything? So that's the operative question now.
I guess we should ask what the tariffs are meant to accomplish. They could be a shield, the idea being, hey, if we make Chinese goods more expensive, we'll get more production and jobs here in the U.S., or they could be a sword, trying to use them as a weapon to get China to do business differently. What is the intent of this wave of tariffs that we have?
Yeah, so, we think about going back to kind of the beginnings of like, what were some of the goals of the tariffs in the first place, right? We have to go back to the kind of the politics during the Trump administration. There were two main goals. One was to balance U.S.-China trade. We were importing more from China than we were exporting to China. So that was one goal. Another goal was to change Chinese market practices, which had become quite costly for U.S. businesses in China, particularly ones that were operating in capital-intensive value-added sectors that were competing with Chinese domestic industry that China was trying to promote with such policies as Made in China 2020. And so in some ways, some of those goals were not, any different from perhaps goals that previous administration had. But what was important or different about the politics under the Trump administration was that Trump departed from more multilateral practices, such as working with WTO appellate body, and then also the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which had, the idea was to exclude China and expand U.S. trade relations with other countries in the Asia Pacific. So these were some of the goals. And the question now is, well, has the trade war actually, achieved some of what we were trying to do, right? Balance U.S.-China trade and to change Chinese market practices. In many ways, in some ways, the trade war did not push China to meet more commitments to purchase U.S. goods. It hasn't necessarily changed market practices within China, right? Less hostility towards U.S. businesses, because China continues to want to promote domestic industry. And so the question then becomes, well, then, have these tariffs, been negative for U.S. businesses? And, one of the questions that you began the introduction with that you asked was, are there industries in the United States that have been hurt by the tariffs, industries that use imports from China? And, if we have slapped these tariffs on these inputs, then it becomes more expensive to produce these goods that uses Chinese imported inputs. And so these are kind of some of the questions that we need to think about. Are we actually, is the U.S. economy being hurt because of these tariffs? At the same time, the tariffs have diversified U.S. Supply networks, right? Move us away from relying on Chinese supply chains and diversified the type of supply chain networks that we could utilize globally. And also the tariffs haven't, in particular ways, perhaps spurred, import competing industries in the United States to produce certain intermediate goods or sector products. So, it's a balance. And I do think that what we need to do as we move forward is to think carefully, not about tariffs, not necessarily in a wholesale way, but to think about, what are some costs and benefits of the tariffs and what are some trade-offs.
Rosalind Shea is with us from Temple University. She has a new book out looking at economic development in countries including China. We're talking about U.S. tariffs on China. If getting rid of some of them, all of them, would help deal with inflation in the U.S., if there are goals that the tariffs can accomplish that make us want to keep them there, join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see those tariffs stay in place or go away? Does this affect your business? Do you wish you could sell something in China that you can't currently? Do you rely on products from China for your business? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Rosalind, as if the whole economic side of this wasn't complicated enough, there's the strategic side of things. We're seeing with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, countries that want to have sanctions on Russia also depend on Russian natural gas, for example, to keep their houses warm in the winter. How much of a factor is reliance on China for potentially significant strategic goods playing into all of this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question that political scientists, we have to think about. It's not just economic, and so much of economics is also very affected by politics. And, with Russia's invasion in Ukraine and, China potentially being kind of an ally to Russia on this, we have to think about, do we really want to necessarily rely on supply chain networks that are rooted in China? And perhaps we need to continue to diversify our supply chain networks. And then one of the benefits or products of the tariffs over the years have been that diversification of supply chains, right? Now that, there are certain products coming in from China that have tariffs making them more expensive, then perhaps the United States and, we need to look into other places around the world that could supply those products. And certainly there are other places in the world that do that.
Now, Wisconsin is a big manufacturing state and agricultural state, and I know a lot of people would like to be selling stuff to China. Under some of the agreements between the Trump administration and China, there were commitments, and you referred to them earlier, that China was supposed to buy X amount of our stuff. Is stuff from places like Wisconsin actually going to China or not so much?
Yeah, you know, and that was one of the kind of one of the terms of the phase one agreement. And, you know, what we've seen is that, in fact, China hasn't necessarily met many of those commitments. And so that does call into question, you know, is this trade war, in fact, a leverage for us to get China to change some of its market practices? So they're not necessarily, you know, if buying more products from the United States and some of its market practices, you know, within China in terms of U.S. business access to markets within China hasn't necessarily changed over time. Now, you know, is this an issue of the U.S. trade war not, you know, meeting some of its goals, or is this an issue of, you know, Chinese globalization strategy? And, you know, in my own research, where I trace kind of China's globalization and subsequent re-regulation across industries, what I have found is that even before China's entry into the WTO, which was supposed to make China, you know, quote unquote, a normal trading country, in fact, before WTO and even since WTO, some of these practices haven't necessarily changed. You know, China continues to promote and domestic industries that are capital intensive and value added, that contribute to the national technology base and have applications for national security, and yet at the same time had liberalized its economy and introduced competition. And so those kind of strategic goals on China's end haven't necessarily changed, and I don't foresee changing necessarily its economic behavior. And so if those things don't change, then, you know, what should the United States do to make sure that it does? You know, the Trump administration, you know, had its solution, right? The trade war. And for the Biden administration going forward, you know, what should we continue the trade war, or should it be a more nuanced strategy? You know, because in my mind, the devil is in the details.
We're talking to Rosalind Shea. She is an expert on U.S.-China trade at Temple University, with us today for a look at the still ongoing trade war with China as the Biden administration considers easing some tariffs on Chinese goods to deal with inflation. That is not a done deal by any means. You can join in at 800-642-1234. A couple of few years back, this was a hot topic. Not a lot of you calling on this right now. Is this off the radar for you? Are you not worried about trade and tariffs and trade with China right now? Is this something that affects your own livelihood? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Rosalind Shea of Temple University, with us today to talk about a move being considered by the Biden administration to lower tariffs on Chinese goods, in part to try to bring down inflation, and looking at the overall effects of the Trump-era tariffs so far. Many of those tariffs still in place, with some exemptions also still in place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The tariffs, should they stay or should they go? Do you worry about China and how it competes on the world market? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to a caller now. Jack is with us in Milwaukee. Jack, hi.
Hello. The reason I'm calling is I understand there's a lot of economic issues that we face with China, but I think the topic is a little too narrow. Years ago, it was argued that you do not train with the Chinese communists because they were such a threat in the spread of communism. And today, and over the years, because there was moderation, for example, under Deng Xiaoping and others, they did increase trade. But the theory was they were going to moderate as they became wealthier. This has not come to pass. In fact, under the current guy, he's acting a bit more authoritarian. And we're seeing more threats about Taiwan, and they're helping the Russians right now.
And Jack, thanks for the call. I heard roughly the same thing in my poli-sci classes circa 30 years ago or so, Rosalind, that increased trade would liberalize China over the long term. Jack and many others are saying that's not happening.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, you know, in my work on China's regulatory state, that's what I point out, that in fact, the Chinese government has used strategic re-regulation after the introduction of competition, after becoming a member of the World Trade Organization, to basically re-regulate the Chinese economy to maximize the benefits of globalization, right? The knowledge and technology transfers of foreign direct investment and minimize the cost. In that, you know, does China have to, you know, change its practices in terms of, you know, market entry, in terms of, you know, allowing more business scope, right? And in many ways, the Chinese has done a lot of the advantages, but meanwhile has minimized many of the potential costs on on Chinese domestic industrial development, and also. Meanwhile, also has increased its ability for authoritarian control, right? New technology comes in, builds the telecommunications infrastructure. At the same time, the government continues to control information dissemination by limiting market entry in certain sectors of telecommunications. And so in some ways, the world has we're confronting now, in some ways, a more open China economically, but a China that is now more stronger with more state capacity and has now ability to compete with the world economically, but politically continues to assert authoritarian control, which will have effects on global politics, including China's support for Russia right now, or at least implicit support for Russia right now in the invasion into Ukraine.
Jack, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. David joins us now in the town of Raymond. David, hello.
Good afternoon. A topic important to me. I work for a very, very large Wisconsin manufacturer. And my take on the 301 tariffs is the only thing that has happened is increased cost to American manufacturing, importing, ultimately the consumers, that it has not resulted in gaining any strategic advantage against China, and it's resulted in a massive revenue shift from the consumer into the government, and God only knows how these 301 tariff monies are actually being spent.
David, thanks for that call. Thanks for sharing the experience of your business. Rosalind, David, seeing higher costs, not a lot of difference in China.
Yeah, you know, the various lists of goods are under the tariffs. I mean, it's quite comprehensive, right? We have, you know, from solar panels and washing machines to wine pork pipes, robotics, information communication technology, and, you know, you name it. And so it's so comprehensive that in many ways, we do need to, you know, the country be more strategic in terms of, you know, how do we target, you know, goods for tariffs that could benefit, you know, United States consumers, but also United States industry. And as David pointed out, you know, many industries are suffering as well because of the increased cost of inputs, and consumers are not benefiting necessarily. And so, as I mentioned, the devil's in the details. How do we, you know, have tariffs that are going to be targeted enough that, in fact, actually benefit consumers and industry? And one way to move forward is to expand the list of exempted products, and then also, you know, look through carefully the several different lists of products that we have under the tariffs, and do a complete examination to make sure that, in fact, the U.S. economy is benefiting. Because I do think that having some lines of tariffs could be of leverage for the United States economically and politically, but we have to be careful we don't hurt ourselves.
Thanks for that call. Rosalind, I want to spend a couple minutes on an alternative. You mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership earlier, this idea that the U.S. and a bunch of other Pacific countries would have this trade deal without China. It would help put leverage on China and benefit the countries involved. Donald Trump ran against it in 2016. So did Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton had to turn against it. There was this kind of big groundswell of movement against it. But do you think that could have been a strategy to accomplish some of the things that the tariffs haven't so far?
Yeah, indeed. The Trump administration, the first act in office was to get the United States out of the TPP. I do think, of course, hindsight is always 2020. But I do think that a possibility of a strategy that is more multilateral, that brings in more countries that could be allies to the United States in terms of working with China, could have been a strategy that would have been very helpful and help us, even if we don't balance U.S.-China trade, we could have expanded U.S. markets elsewhere. We could have increased U.S.'s economic effects globally and also, increasing and moving away from even relying on China as a place for supply chains. So there, I think those kind of other more multilateral strategies could have benefited the United States. Rather, instead of what happened was we, in many ways, alienated China because there were counter tariffs as well for the against the U.S. China's part against U.S. China trade war, and alienated China, and also in some ways did not, do benefits for our relations with other places in the world.
Rosalind, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
That's Rosalind Shea, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University, with us today to talk about whether reducing tariffs on Chinese goods would impact inflation in the U.S. and what effect it could all have on America's trading relationship with China. A lot of moving parts there. Her latest book, by the way, is called Micro-Institutional Foundations of Capitalism, Sectoral Pathways to Globalization in China, India, and Russia. That book will come out later this month. And you can keep sharing your thoughts on tariffs and trade with China. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Start your weekday with great conversations on The Morning Show. Coming up tomorrow morning at 8, the ACLU is raising concerns over free speech and discrimination in a Wisconsin school district. The latest in a lot of questions and tensions about what's going on in schools. Find out more and join in the conversation if you'd like. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Hey, video game fans, what for you is a game that stood the test of time? The World Video Game Hall of Fame has some new answers to that question. Their new list of inductees just came out from the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. The Hall of Fame includes video games, computer games, and games for phones and tablets. Here are the newest games on the list. Ms. Pac-Man, long overdue. I played that and Pac-Man itself back in the day. By the way, the original Pac-Man was in the original list of Hall of Famers. Dance Dance Revolution, that makes a lot of sense. I've never done it. I'm a surprisingly bad dancer. I think the game would probably make fun of me, even if it's not programmed to. The Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time. I played that some. My younger brother had it. I checked it out. My kids played some of the later versions. And Sid Meier's Civilization. I played the first version of that so much, including at least one all-nighter and follow-ups with later versions. Check out the full Video Game Hall of Fame and more online at www.museumofplay.org. Video game news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Music has served as a form of political and social expression in the U.S. going back to the Revolutionary War and beyond. When we think of protest music, we might jump to the Vietnam War era of the 1960s and 70s, like Fortunate Son by Creedence Clearwater Revival. But artists throughout the 20th century and on to today continue to write songs that offer commentary on pressing issues. What's changed over the years? Is the golden age of the protest song over, or have things just changed? You can join in at 800-642-1234. When I say protest music, what does that mean to you? What do you think of? What era do you think of? What performer or song? Is there a song or artist from a particular time that stays with you? Do you notice when music has a political or social message behind it? Do you want music to have political or social messages behind it, or do you want music to get away from those things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison who teaches about music and culture. He's also a voter for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Alexander, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's nice to be back.
Well, I imagine protest music has been around since there was music, but when did it really get mainstream popularity in the U.S.? When, you know, it wasn't just the people, you know, singing it, but it became part of pop culture?
Well, that's a great question. Of course, there has been, as you noted, music about protest and music about politics as long as we have had music. If you think about it, songs about war are certainly songs that are political, and those are among the oldest songs we have in human culture. So the idea of having political music has always existed, and it has always existed in the United States. In every single era, we have songs that are about the political conditions that we are in, songs of protest as well. In the modern recorded era, you can find songs about the Depression, you can find songs about World War II. There's really no era in which there isn't music about politics and protest, whether it's about the economy and poverty, whether it's about war, whether it's about the changes in society, whether it's about race relations or gender. They have always been there. But in the modern era that really starts with the birth of rhythm and blues and rock and roll, it is the 60s, the mid-60s into the early 70s, that is the first period that we really look at a moment when there is a kind of merging of protest music and popular music, popular hits that are consistently songs about what is going on in American society in explicit ways. So that's really the moment when it starts in that particular era. And it is also, you know, in part a way in which we periodize that, because that is the moment that many of us first remember that popular political music emerging.
Is there a significant difference between, you know, a song with political lyrics and songs that people might sing at a protest? You know, is there something different with the communal experience of singing "We Shall Overcome" at a civil rights rally, or "This Land Is Our Land" or whatever, versus, you know, a song that you kind of passively listen to?
Well, obviously, it can be a different experience. If you are listening to the song by yourself in isolation, or if you're driving in your car, it may have you thinking about politics. It may have you contemplating political action in some form or another, but you're by yourself. And so the relationship is between your own thoughts and the art itself. That is part of the call and response, the longstanding tradition in which music helps to form community and creates a kind of dialogue between the art and individuals. But that becomes much more straightforward and explicit when it happens in a communal setting. So if people are singing the music together at a march, at a protest, in a performance, then there is a kind of shared sense of identity and a shared sense of purpose that comes out of singing that song and relating it to the situation that you are in.
Let's dive into songs related to civil rights now. You sent us some suggestions for influential or important protest-related songs. "People Get Ready" by Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions from 1965, kind of a movement anthem. Here's a listen.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on.
Those of us listening with headphones getting a stereo there back and forth. Alexander, why did songs like that one, "People Get Ready," resonate well with people in the fight for civil rights?
So the fight for civil rights was a longstanding one for African Americans. Of course, as long as African Americans have been on this continent, they have struggled to gain civil rights and to have equal opportunity to be both citizens and to be politically active in American society. So it has always been part of the African-American struggle. And that struggle has been at times very deeply tied to the church The church was a location where people could gather, where African Americans could gather, where they could talk about the struggles that they were experiencing, where they could escape from those struggles and find refuge and community and joy. And so the sounds of gospel music have long been a sound that African Americans have used as a way to express their view of the world, including through politics. Now, that has often been metaphorical through gospel music, and it's one of the reasons why African Americans could get away with singing those songs, because they were metaphorical as opposed to being explicit. As we get into the era of rhythm and blues and soul, what we see are artists who are deeply grounded in the gospel tradition and in the gospel impulse, the idea of finding redemption or finding a better place both in this world and beyond, and they translate it into secular music. So as they do that, they take many of the sounds of community, of redemption, of gathering together to make progress, and they translate them from a purely religious setting into one that is more or less secular. And that's what a song like People Get Ready by Curtis Mayfield does. Curtis Mayfield, who was from Chicago, was deeply connected to church music, and then took that lesson and those experiences and brought them into the pop music that he was creating. So a song like People Get Ready, it's about the train to Jordan. It is not just literally about that, but it is also, even more importantly, metaphorically, about the idea of finding a way for people to get to the promised land, to get to the place that they want to be, where they can find happiness, where they can find freedom. And that's really the purpose of the song.
We are talking about the history of protest music in the United States with Alexander Shashko, who teaches about music and culture at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions, maybe your favorite songs, artists, memories of protest music at 800-642-1234. Brian joins us now in Green Bay. Brian, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Brian?
Well, I wanted to bring up a band that is alternative rock or maybe punk rock in its origin that started in, I believe, the 90s, known as Rage Against the Machine. And they were a political band that decided to do the opposite of the Gospels, actually. Instead of being metaphorical, they were very direct in their message. And singer, songwriter, and activist lead singer, the indefatigable Zach De La Rocha, and the guitarist, Mr. Tom Morello, who is insurmountable in his talents, both have continued to create music and are continuing to be on tour given the time and age that we live in, and continue to spread a political message that is a bit more in your face. And the band name being Rage Against the Machine seems to speak for itself, in my opinion, as to their message and their purpose as a band.
Brian, thanks for the call. Alexander.
Well, you're not going to hear me disagree with you about the importance of Rage Against the Machine. I actually did vote for them when they were a nominee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. They did not get in. I think it's probably a matter of time before they do. But in any event, I absolutely agree about Rage Against the Machine being a really important band in the history of both rock music and also the history of protest music. Tom Morello is an incredibly innovative guitarist, and the group really took on the mantle of protest bands that had come before them, both from the world of rock and punk in particular, but also from hip hop. And part of what makes Rage Against the Machine such a powerful group is that they're really probably the most both musically influential and politically active of all of the bands that are kind of rap rock hybrid groups, the groups that draw from both the rock tradition and the hip hop tradition. And so what you hear when you listen to Rage Against the Machine is a group that is drawing on groups from the MC5 to the Clash on the rock side of things, but also drawing from groups like Public Enemy on the hip hop side of things. And in the process, bringing together a kind of fusion of those two worlds that is also meant to represent a way of bridging those two worlds and looking for common cause, because it's often the case both with musical genres and with protest that they often can't hear one another or can't work with one another because they're so devoted to the particular issues that they're dealing with. And part of what Rage Against the Machine was trying to accomplish, both symbolically symbolically through their sound and explicitly through their lyrics, was to bring those two worlds together.
Brian, thanks for the call. I'm sorry, we didn't pull any Rage Against the Machine, but in these more in-your-face style, Alexander, you just mentioned Public Enemy. Here's their 1988 Fight the Power.
Gotta give us what we want. Gotta give us what we need.
Hey.
Our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power.
So, Alexander, the hip-hop thread there, obviously a very different sound than the more mellow Curtis Mayfield we heard earlier.
Absolutely. A different sound. Although certainly there was a point later when Curtis Mayfield was a lot closer to Public Enemy than he was with People Get Ready. But yeah, that is the sound of frustration and of anger. But above all, it's really a sound that is just trying to get people's attention. For many African-Americans, especially younger generations of African-Americans in the 1980s, they felt that their voices were not being heard in the political discourse of the day, that much of the dialogue about race relations was, in their view, a kind of tired discussion of whether or not the civil rights movement had fully succeeded, about whether or not race relations was something that had been somehow resolved in the 1960s, and that there really wasn't a lot more to talk about. And what a group like Public Enemy was trying to accomplish was to be heard through all of that static, and to be heard when there was a lot of silence about the experience that young African-Americans and young African-American men in particular were experiencing and dealing with. And so they created both lyrics that were purposefully confrontational and more importantly, in my opinion, a sound that was purposely confrontational, that they wanted the sound of sirens. They wanted the sound of the city. They wanted a chaotic kind of sound that would grab you by the lapels and force you to pay attention to them so that you couldn't turn away from the things that they wanted to say. And in that sense, they really took political hip hop to a different level. It had already existed. Grandmaster Flash's and the Furious Five's The Message, of course, was the first big political hip hop song. And there were groups like Boogie Down Production. But Public Enemy really take it to an entirely different level. They make politics the centerpiece of the music that they're creating and thus create an opening for hip hop artists to be more politically engaged through their music.
We're talking about the history and evolution of protest music in the U.S. with UW-Madison lecturer Alexander Shashko. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your favorites, your memories about protest music. 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. That's Bruce Springsteen's 1984 hit, Born in the USA, his response to the end of the Vietnam War and how veterans were treated when they returned home. We continue our talk about protest and political music, how it's changed across the decades. Alexander Shashko is with us, lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, who teaches about music and culture. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Oh, well, this goes back. The tried and true Buffalo Springfield, 1966, for what it's worth. Everybody's right, but everybody's wrong. And that goes with every battle, every outcry, every protest we've ever had, and we're still having with an adulterated Supreme Court going against women's reproductive rights. It's right there. And then my second is Richie Havens, Freedom. That is just a constant. He sang his heart out at Woodstock and made that song. And if it's not everybody's anthem, it should be.
Gail, thanks for the call. And that was interesting, Alexander. She talked about how the same song, in this case, For What It's Worth, could apply to a lot of different situations. A lasting protest song may fit a lot of different circumstances.
Absolutely. And that is a song that has survived through the years, that any time there has been a moment of political turmoil, especially regarding war, For What It's Worth has emerged again. It is a song that not only got played again when the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan began, but it was covered artists at that time and sampled. And in fact, Stephen Stills is actually on a Public Enemy song in which they sample For What It's Worth, a song called He Got Game. And so that tradition of taking those old songs and reimagining them in a new era has lived on to this day. It's certainly lived on into the era of hip hop. And that has happened for a long time. If you think about what artists like Richie Havens were doing during the folk revival, much of what they were doing was to draw from political folk music from an earlier era, from the 1920s or 30s or 40s, and then to both, you know, play those songs again in the context of a new time and draw off of those musical traditions to create new songs to fit the times that they are in. So both of those artists and those songs that they performed really represent a link in the chain of tradition, both past and into our present day, in which those songs live on as anthems for a kind of protest that people want to engage in.
Thanks for that call, Gail. We'll go to Tom now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. There was a song that was sung a lot during the Vietnam War era. It was written by a folk singer, Native American woman, Buffy St. Marie, and it was covered by a British folk singer, Donovan, called The Universal Soldier. Spoke about how patriots of any country fight for love of their own country.
Tom, thanks for the call. Alexander?
Yeah, that is absolutely a song that sort of creates this complex scenario in which it is engaging in both the questions of the importance of war, but also the importance of country and identity and who's responsible for fighting. Is a soldier someone who is responsible for making the choices about whether they fight or whether they are, or are they someone who is, you know, being asked to do their part for the community within which they live? You know, ultimately what it says is that everyone needs to be responsible for their own actions and everyone needs to make their own choices. And of course, in the context of the Vietnam War, that was a very, very heated subject because between the draft and those who were choosing to fight, there were a lot of hard individual choices between a sense of duty, a sense of patriotism to country, and then a sense of patriotism to ideas, or a sense of justice and in terms of fighting war and of being someone who's willing to kill in order to win that war. And so that those kind of complicated questions are always part of any kind of protest music tradition, especially when it comes to war. There's a whole subgenre of music, and it's really not a subgenre, it's its own genre, that are songs about the experience of the soldiers themselves. And Fortunate Son, which you played earlier, is a prime example of that. That is a song that is not taking a position so strongly on the import or on the on whether or not the Vietnam War should be fought, but rather on who is fighting it and what the consequences are for both those who fight it and those who do not. So that question about individual responsibility and the choices that we make is one that we often hear when it comes to political music, and especially political music about war.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to take our last few minutes, Alexander, to look at political music today. I think it's easy to turn and say, okay, yeah, the 60s, early 70s, that was the golden age, not so much anymore. You don't buy that, though.
I do not. There is lots of political music. Now, there are a few reasons why that may not seem as apparent as it has in the past. One is that there's just so much music today that there's more of everything, including protest music. It's also the case that in the internet age and in the world of streaming that we're in, and in a world of instantaneous and mass amounts of information, a protest song doesn't quite have the same kind of time to gather an audience and to become anthemic, because there's just so much popular culture that passes through us on any given day, let alone a week or in a month. And so it's a little bit harder for it to stand out than it had before, but it still does happen. If you think about just a few years ago, a song like All Right by Kendrick Lamar or Formation by Beyonce, typically at a moment when there are social movements going on, those songs then start to have a greater resonance than they would otherwise. The real key to protest music becoming memorable is if there is a movement behind it. It's a kind of symbiotic relationship. The songs are inspired by the movement. The movement is inspired by the songs. The movement might create some of the language or take some of the acts that an artist will then use to write a song. And at the same time, they might be articulating the sentiments of people in the movement that they may not have articulated otherwise for themselves, and they can now sing it in a kind of communal setting. So there is absolutely protest music today. There is lots of protest music today, but it doesn't quite exist in the same kind of cultural and technological context. And I do think that has made a difference in terms of how broadly people recognize it, hear it, and understand it.
Alexander, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
That's Alexander Shashko, lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, with us today for a look at the history of protest music in the United States. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a Mother's Day edition of Food Friday. Get some inspiration for your menu this weekend and share your Mother's Day meal favorites, your plans. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we hear from an abortion rights activist and an anti-abortion rights activist about their views on the possibility of a post-Roe v. Wade America here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.